Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm your host, Juanita Watson, and today on the program, author J.D. Solomon will be joining us. Now, J.D. has just published a historical fiction novel titled The Tynan Killing, which is based on one of his wife's ancestors, an Irish immigrant who served as a Union officer in the Civil War. J.D. Solomon is a graduate of Wesleyan University. He holds a master's degree in journalism from Boston University and a master's in marketing from Fordham University. He has served as an adjunct professor of business communications at the Graduate School of Management at Rutgers University. With nearly 20 years of diverse experience in marketing and business communication, as well as a personal background in entrepreneurism, J.D. Solomon offers specialized marketing expertise to startup and growing businesses. Prior to the late 2008 release of The Tynan Killing, J.D. authored the book Overcoming Macular Degeneration, A Guide to Seeing Beyond the Clouds, and that was released in 2000. J.D.'s website is thetynankillingsbook.com, and you can find out all sorts of information about this latest release and J.D.'s personal endeavors. So that being said, I'm so happy to have J.D. on the program today. Welcome, J.D.
Thanks, Juanita. It's a pleasure to be speaking with you and your listeners here today.
Yeah, wonderful. So, you know, this is a very interesting man that you are writing about. This is your wife's great-great-grandfather, Patrick Sherman Tynan?
That's right. He is a direct ancestor of my wife. As you said, he was born in Ireland. He was born actually on March 17th in 1835. So that made his name, I guess, Patrick, a foregone conclusion. His family came over during the famine. They successfully made it to Philadelphia, where he was raised. And he was a very interesting man. He was active in the Irish militia in Philadelphia. That little bit of military experience, I guess, it qualified him to become a second lieutenant. At the start of the war, he enlisted in what would become the famed Pennsylvania 69th Regiment, a highly regarded regiment that fought in virtually every major battle in the East. And over the course of the war, he rose in rank from second lieutenant to major and was commanding the regiment near the end of the war. So he was a very successful officer, and in fact, he had a small but very important role at the Battle of Gettysburg.
So he was really very significant. He's a significant historical figure in the whole Civil War history.
Well, he is not, but he's one of those unsung heroes.
Mm-hmm.
At one point some years ago, I was talking about him to the chief historian at Gettysburg National Military Park, who immediately recognized the name and, in fact, told me that Pat Tynan was one of his favorite officers of the Army of the Potomac. He said that he incorporates Tynan into most of his lectures as an illustration of a common man who showed uncommon valor at that particular battle and also at other times during the war.
Well, how much is really written about him? Obviously, if we have, you know, a professor that is talking about him, there's obviously quite a bit out there.
Well, not really. Again, he used as an illustration of a common man who showed uncommon valor, but there's not a lot about him alone. There's quite a bit about his regiment, the Pennsylvania 69th, which was a very noted regiment.
How many were in that regiment?
Well, its authorized strength was 1,000, but it was rarely that high because of casualties and desertions and other issues. But most of the war, he was a company commander leading a company which would have been authorized at 100 men. But as I say later on, he was commander of the regiment. It was a highly interesting regiment. There were murders in the regiment. There was other mysteries. The regimental battle flag mysteriously disappeared at some point. So it was a lot of colorful characters in that regiment.
And they were very patriotic, obviously.
Very patriotic, despite, in fact, challenges. It was an Irish regiment out of Philadelphia. There had been quite a bit of anti-Irish sentiment in Philadelphia in that time period. And in fact, as they were marching out of Philadelphia at the beginning of the war, their regiment was pelted with vegetables and stones and bricks by a population that was, as I said, very anti-Irish. Nevertheless, they fought valiantly for the Union and earned a very high degree of respect as the war went on from their colleagues and comrades in other regiments.
I wonder where that initial patriotism came from with them.
Well, they predominantly immigrants came over from Ireland during the famine to a much better life. And although their lives in Philadelphia were challenged by poverty and very hard work and long hours, it was certainly better than what they would have experienced during the famine in Ireland.
Mm-hmm. So they were fighting for that.
They were. The Irish regiments in the Civil War, there was another well-known regiment from New York, also the New York 69th from New York, was a highly regarded regiment. They were good fighters. They were good soldiers. There was some prejudice against them on the part of the Army and the officer corps, but they these Irish regiments consistently performed courageously and valiantly and were dedicated to the Union.
Well, what was it personally, J.D., that impressed you so much about him to the point of actually writing this book?
Well, you know, he was an interesting man. He clearly was intelligent and, as I said, courageous. He was a leader, probably a natural soldier, and he achieved great success during the war. After the war, he lived to the ripe old age of 86, outliving his wife, who died when he was in his 50s. He outlived all five of his children, tragically enough. And but he never leveraged his experience during the war into a career after the war. He made a living at odd jobs, assistant bartender, an assistant paper hanger, a night watchman, long periods of unemployment. And clearly was fighting some kinds of personal demons after the war, a condition not uncommon to soldiers and to veterans of the Civil War, and somewhat similar to the experience of Vietnam veterans during the 70s and 80s here. So it always intrigued me what his life was like and what drove him, what motivated him, what frustrated him. And one of my goals in writing this novel was to address some of these issues.
Now, was he showing that type of leadership, that type of intelligence before he actually got in with the military, with the militia?
Not much is known about him. There are no letters, no diaries, no firsthand original reports. So it's very hard to make accurate judgments about what he was like. But during the period before the war, he was very actively involved in these Irish militias that were dedicated to the perhaps somewhat fantastical concept of going back to Ireland and freeing Ireland from the British. But it was also a social organization. These were social organizations and protective of the Irish community. So he was very involved with that. From the beginning of the war, he was a recruitment ringleader. His name is on recruitment posters and in advertisements at the time. So he was certainly a leader. He was must have been very excited about the war. And what I've read about his orders, his letters, his official correspondence, and there's some of that survives, a thoughtful person and been highly regarded by his fellow officers.
Do you remember when you first actually heard about him?
I do. It was probably the first time that I met my wife's father, the man who would become my father-in-law, who was Pat Tynan's great-grandson. He was kind of a little bit of a quirky guy. In fact, my wife took pains to warn me en route to that visit that he often found it convenient to clean his handgun upon first meeting his daughter's boyfriend. No handgun ultimately was in sight when I was there, but he all of a sudden, out of the blue, mentioned that his great grandfather was a hero at Gettysburg, and in fact, he said there was a statue of Pat Tynan at Gettysburg. I kind of chalked that up to quirkiness, rolled my eyes, but some months later, my wife and I went to Gettysburg on a visit and, in fact, learned about him and his regiment, and from that point on, I sort of was hooked and spent well over 20 years investigating this man's life.
So when did you actually know that you were going to be writing a book?
I always knew I wanted to write a book. I just didn't know what it was going to be. As I said, there was because there was no firsthand accounts, no letters, no diaries, couldn't write a biography of him. Didn't want to write a story of his wartime experiences based on his regiment's history. Didn't think that would be interesting. So didn't really know what I wanted to do, but it came to me at some point, say, gee, I wonder if I could just write a novel that used him as a character, a novel that would be interesting to anybody, but which would have a plot device through which I could tell his story. And then I started fiddling with ideas for that plot, and that's how the Tynan killings evolved.
Well, tell us then about this novel. You know, I was wondering why you didn't just write a historical account of his life. I mean, it seems so just incredible in itself, but clearly there just isn't enough about him in historical documents to do that.
Right. I knew I would have had to have, added enough kind of fiction to it to pad it out, so decided instead to do it through this novel. I wanted to write a novel that people might want to read and would enjoy regardless of their level of interest in this particular man or even in the Civil War. And that's why I chose to create this novel, which is really, it's a whodunit. It's a thriller.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And a thriller mystery.
That's right. And it would be of interest, and I've gotten feedback from people who, again, had very little background or knowledge about the Civil War and found just the story interesting. So it enabled me to tell his story in the context of entertainment, which was something I wanted to do.
Must have been great fun for you to write as well. Why don't you tell us then a little bit about the plot of this actual novel?
Sure. The novel is set in April of 1898, when Tynan, in fact, really was living at a massive old soldier's home. It happened to be in Virginia, although it was only for Union soldiers. And the book takes place, or it starts, at this location in roughly near Newport News, Virginia, with a murder. And the murder is of Tynan's son, and it's actually a double murder. Tynan's son and daughter-in-law are brutally murdered after his son, whose name was Thomas, blundered an attempt to blackmail a very powerful financier.
Now, is any of that part true?
No.
Nothing, okay.
Tynan did outlive all of his children. He had one, his only grown child, was a son, Thomas. Now I'm talking reality.
Mm-hmm.
Thomas died of mysterious circumstances, leading Pat Tynan to raise both of Thomas's children. Now, the only reason it strikes me that Pat Tynan would have had to have raised those kids was if not only Thomas, but Thomas's wife had died. Family folklore is that Patrick's son Thomas was hanged as a horse thief, but that may just be a rumor from my quirky father-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
But regardless, I used that as this kind of the bud to grow this murder mystery. Mm. So in the book, in the fiction, we're back to fiction now, Tynan's son Thomas, a failed Klondike prospector, is murdered after a kind of a bungled attempt to blackmail a powerful financier. This happened down in Virginia, and the investigative authority, the lawman, the sheriff, the local sheriff, in the book is named Sheriff Roberts, and in the book he is the son of a Confederate officer who was killed at Gettysburg. So you can see where I'm leading up to this mismatched buddy theme between Tynan, the Union hero at Gettysburg, the aging veteran, and this younger man who was the son of a man who was killed at Gettysburg, north and south there. They together have to investigate this murder. Their investigation takes them to Philadelphia, and where they get some help, unexpected help, from Tynan's estranged daughter. And they are they have to track down this financier before he commits his next crime, which involves human trafficking. And so the book weaves in the sort of the essential ingredients of a thriller. There's these lurid crimes of murder and swindling and prostitution and human trafficking. There's this mismatched buddy theme of an aging Union veteran with a younger son of a Confederate officer.
Mm-hmm.
There's even a romantic interest that evolves between Tynan's daughter and this Virginia sheriff. So it has the essential elements.
And a lot of characters, apparently.
There are a lot of characters. The book is told, though, kind of concurrently through the perspective of the main characters. There is no dominant narrator. The book is told through the various perspectives of these different characters whose experiences intersect at various points during the story.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Hi there. Are you looking for new ways to promote your book? Why not consider being interviewed live? With the huge impact internet radio as well as podcasting is making in our society, your voice can now be heard worldwide. Let Juanita at Inside Scoop Live create the necessary steps for you. You will not only receive a web page of your own, but your interview will be available for MP3 download and RSS feed. As well, your interview will be posted on venues such as iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, Podcast Alley, and the Inside Scoop Live blog. Go to InsideScoopLive.com today for more information. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Just to remind you, I'm talking today with J.D. Solomon. He is the author of The Tynan Killings, and you can find out more about J.D. and his book at thetynankillingsbook.com. Now, I understand that the whole time span of this novel is actually only about 3 weeks.
It's just 3 weeks in April of 1898, and that was a very interesting time. It was, of course, it was the Klondike Gold Rush, the start of the Spanish-American War. The reason I chose that is that I feel for these veterans, men like Tynan and the other Civil War veterans, that must have been a very kind of a bittersweet time. As they recalled April of 1861, the start of the Civil War, and what their experiences were then, as they were then much younger men, obviously, caught up in war fever at the time and driven to enlist in a war that they thought certainly was going to be very short and relatively easy. Here it is now, these years later, same month, same kind of war fever going on. The Spanish-American War was the first major conflict that the United States had been in since the Civil War, and the same kind of war fever sweeping through the land. But now these veterans in their 50s and their 60s, they must have had some interesting thoughts about what the country might be getting into here in this April yet again.
Mm-hmm.
As war fever was sweeping the country.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting that you really took that whole context of war veterans, and I know this is somewhat close to your heart. I mean, you've even added this into the subtitle of your book, A Novel of Civil War Veterans. So tell us a little bit about your thoughts on that and the whole experience of being a war veteran.
It was a mixed experience for this generation of men who fought in the Civil War. It was a horrific experience, the war itself, and my research told me that they experienced a tremendous degree of what we now would call post-traumatic stress
mm-hmm.
disorder. Of course, many of them became very successful and leaders in the economy and finance and industry, but many veterans did not. And this was one of the reasons that the government built this huge network of old soldiers' homes, which is really America's first experiment in essentially subsidized living. And these guys could go there, and thousands and thousands of them chose to live in these massive, beautiful, but nevertheless massive institutions. and they had a tough time adjusting.
Were they given help there, or just accommodation?
Well, they could stay there, they could eat there. In terms of counseling, I doubt there was anything significant. They went there because they had to, because they were either unable to work because of injuries or because of post-traumatic stress disorder, because they didn't have families to take care of them. These things were beautiful. They were park-like. They were tourist attractions in their own right because they were so handsomely designed, and the architecture was wonderful, big, expansive grounds. But the men hated being there. And I bring this out in my book. They felt like they were being warehoused, and in a sense they were. And it was an unnatural kind of way to live, but it was necessary. They had no place else to go. It was a generation that fought very hard for America. And by the way, there was nothing quite like these institutions for the Confederate veterans. They had statewide systems of soldiers' homes, which were nowhere near as nice as the ones for the Union veterans. But I'm sure they felt envious and also had similar experiences after the war in terms of trouble adjusting. But it was, again, in many ways parallel to the experience of the Vietnam veterans. And by the way, 1898 was closer to the end of the Civil War than we are today from the end of the Vietnam War. So it really was not all that far removed at that time that the book, when the book takes place. Memories of the war were still relatively recent.
Really recent. Mm-hmm. And with the significance of the war, I mean, it would have, definitely sparked a lot in the people of that time.
It's also a time, though, of transition, because at that point, the veterans of the Civil War were ending their productive phases of their lives. They were in their 50s and their 60s, and a new generation was chafing at the bit to take over and move on. It was almost the turn of the century, and industrialization was happening, all these new inventions, telephone, electricity, even the automobile, and soon would be flight. So it was a dramatic new time, and I would also felt that it would also have been difficult for this generation of aging, but not really quite very elderly men yet, to see that their roles as dominant in the economy and in politics was being surpassed and eclipsed by this new generation.
That's interesting. And it almost seems like you brought that in a very creative way into your book by really pitting Pat up with the younger character.
That's exactly the theme that I was trying to exhibit. And this sheriff has political ambitions. He wants to run for Congress. He has to solve this murder first. He is, he's often just kind of antsy and irritated by these older veterans. He wants to see them kind of get out of the way, that whole generation get out of the way, so that at the time of the book, he's 38 or 40 years old, and he's just anxious to move on and charge into the 20th century, mm-hmm. and just get out from under the thumb of the Civil War generation and all their references to these old battles and the war stories. And it's just enough of that. Let's move on.
So did you find that there was any challenges in writing this and is a historical fiction? You know, it can be a really difficult genre to write in, because you're having to completely transport a reader into a different time and place and make it believable and somehow relatable. How did you find that when you were in the writing process?
Well, I decided to do that through the use of detail. I pored over old maps of Philadelphia, which is where most of the story takes place. I looked at street names and at the hotel names at the time. So the characters are staying in real hotels. The locations are all accurate. Even some of the secondary characters are real people from that time period. At one point they have to, or the characters are deciding to go to a show, and I actually researched to see what shows were playing in Philadelphia at that time so that it would all kind of smell right. And that level of detail, I think, helped believability. It's just one example. At one point, two of the villains have to get cleaned up after a murder. I was wondering where these guys would have cleaned up in Philadelphia. They didn't have a hotel or anything they could go back to. Well, I did some research. It turns out that Philadelphia opened its first bathhouse for the poor in April of 1898, the month in which I was writing this story.
Oh, wow.
Well, that was terrific. So now I could have them not just go to any old bathhouse, but a bathhouse that was having its grand opening.
Wow, yeah.
At the very time in which the story was written. So it just, again, trying to use detail to lend veracity to the story. I had to make a decision regarding dialogue and dialect. If many readers of historical fiction will see a literary style and dialogue or and even a regional dialect that it sometimes can be used to help transport the reader, but I didn't think that I was really accomplished enough writer to do that. Instead, I chose to write in just neutral dialogue, hoping that the reader would implant his or her own voice into this and hear the dialogue as it was meant to be. And I think that that was a very good compromise to do that.
I think that that's an easy leap for a reader when you create so much detail around setting and actual real places and that type of detail.
Yeah, it's, you know, this, if the setting is right and the characters are believable and the plot is believable, I think readers will kind of start hearing these voices in their heads in the way that they would imagine them to speak, and trying to impose dialect and dialogue, it's so hard. I mean, Mark Twain, of course, was the master at this, but you know, if you're not Mark Twain and there's only one of them, one of him, it's just too much of a challenge and too easy to go wrong.
Sure. So when you were actually in the writing process, was there any, what were you keeping conscious in your thoughts in regards to Tynan and preserving his legacy and what you really wanted to put forth to readers about his character and who he was as a man?
Well, first I had to give him sort of a voice, an attitude, a personality, and for that I kind of adopted my father-in-law's voice. They were separated only by a couple of generations, so it was probably an accurate depiction.
Mm-hmm.
And once I had that in my mind, I felt, you know, I could give him more of a believability to his character. I didn't have any strong goals about creating a legacy for him. I think, you know, the Tynan family now has a book that they can turn to and be proud of about this fellow, but I don't have any illusions that he's going to live on in any kind of grander legacy. My really only hope is that for casual readers, this becomes an enjoyable book that might illustrate some of the issues that occur to the men who fought the Civil War and survived it. And particularly some of the experiences of the Irish regiments, but you know, otherwise it's just a kind of a for family members something to be a little proud of, and for the rest of the world something to enjoy.
A great read. So, did you get a thumbs up from your wife's family?
I did. They're all thrilled with this. You know, they see where I weaved in some stories about their experiences that they actually know about, and gave them to Pat Tynan as his stories, and they kind of found that to be a little funny. But they're also a little bit relieved that, as I mentioned before, perhaps the myth of their great-grandfather being hanged as a horse thief has been supplanted by this new myth, a little less ugly, that he was killed as a result of a failed attempt to blackmail an evil financier.
Mm-hmm. That's funny. So what is next for you? Are you going to be continuing to write novels?
I don't know. Mm-hmm. This really primarily was a labor of love after some 20-odd years of research about this man. It was a fun process. I actually miss writing about these characters.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't now have another novel in me, although I did kind of protect myself. There's some of the characters live on, and Tynan's grandson, again, the young man who he raised, was an interesting man in his own right. He ran away from home at age 16 to join the Navy against his grandfather's strong objections, and joined the Navy, served in both World War I and World War II.
Wow.
At sea, and had an interesting life in his own right. So maybe some years from now he'll be the subject of a follow-up novel.
It takes a lot of energy to write a book, so you definitely you need to set that aside in your life. So maybe you need to take a break, it sounds like.
I think so. It's, I was sort of driven to this and loved doing it. It's, but writing books is not my main business. It's
sure.
And as such, it'll have to take second seat to doing things that'll actually make money.
Right. So your website, thetynankillingsbook.com, what can our listeners find there?
Well, they'll find a detailed bibliography of the sources. They'll find a section on the people and events and places that were included in the book, with little photographs and capsule profiles of what they were, you know, some adding some contextual information.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps most interesting, they'll find a blog by Patrick Tynan. It was obviously ghostwritten in all senses of that word, but which comments on the backstory. So correcting some of the sort of plausible but nevertheless fantastical elements of the plot that I included, and giving some perspective as to what things were really like at the time. So that's an interesting read as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, when I was doing some research on you and your book, I came across somewhere, and I'm not sure where it is, but I want to make sure we make mention of it because I thought it was fantastic. You included a lot of pictures of different historical sites and places, you know, like this bathhouse. I think there's a picture of Eastern State Penitentiary, which also plays a big role in your book. Where can we find that?
Well, those are all on the website in that section.
Okay.
On the, about the events and the places and the people. So,
okay.
Yeah, so
I love that.
Like the bathhouse and the penitentiary, and even the regiment's battle flag.
Mm-hmm.
and some of the actual people who were the real people from the regiment who were included in the book. I have their pictures in there, as well as, of course, Tynan's. Now, he's on the cover of the book, but there are some additional pictures of him as an older man. Sadly, I have no photograph of Tynan as an officer, as a younger man, but you can at least see what he looked like as an older man from that portion of the website.
Mm-hmm. Well, fantastic. Well, I'm so happy that you joined us today and told us about your book. I mean, this is very interesting. I think we got a little bit of a history lesson here as well. So I just thank you so much, J.D.
It's been my pleasure, Juanita. Thank you, and I appreciate your listeners tuning in.
Yeah, you bet. Did you have anything, last-minute thoughts that you wanted to share with us before we parted?
I don't think so, other than to say that what I've learned about from readers of this book is that for those who were interested in the Civil War, it's a great read. For those who are not interested or didn't think they were interested in the Civil War, it's just a good old whodunit murder mystery. And I think it may appeal to people on a wide level from that perspective.
Yeah, it's a fantastic book. So thank you so much, J.D. All the best.
Thanks, Juanita.
All right, listeners, that's been J.D. Solomon. His new book, The Tynan Killings, is out now, as mentioned, and his website is thetynankillingsbook.com, and I highly encourage you to go check it out. He has a lot of information about this book, and really do check out the people, places, events link that J.D. has put up there. He's got some fantastic photos, so do check it out. Well, I want to thank you for tuning in again to Inside Scoop Live. I'm Juanita Watson, and until next time.